You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast. This week, the show is sponsored by Hand to God, the most Tony-nominated new American play on Broadway. The New York Times calls Hand to God flat-out hilarious and a true tour de force. And the Huffington Post raves it's the best play of the season. For tickets, visit telecharge.com. And now, on with the podcast.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective Podcast. Before I introduce my next guest, I want to tell you a little story back from the days of the 90s, 1993, when I witnessed my first tech of a Broadway show. It was Grease. I was the production assistant, which meant I got everybody coffee. As you all know, tech is a very arduous process where the cast and the physical elements of the production finally come together. We actually had a lot of moving parts on that show. Lots of scenery, props, a billion Verilights, and cues to go with it. It took us a couple weeks to get through teching the show, and when we did, I remember the PSM saying, "Okay, now let's run it from the top." And I remember thinking, this is going to be a disaster. I had never seen a Broadway show come together, but still, I knew after 2 weeks, there was no way we were going to get through it. And then we started, and we got through it. Just like that. We only stopped, I think it was twice, and it was because the cast had questions. The crew did not. And after the dinner break, I went to the stage manager and I said, "Is this typical for a Broadway show? Is this a fluke? Was this an easy show?" And he said to me verbatim, "Ken, that's what happens when you have the best stagehands in the world working on your show." And today, I'm talking to the leader of those stagehands, James Claffey Jr., the president of Local One, the Stagehands Union. Welcome, Jimmy.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
And Jimmy has a long family tradition in Local One, including five brothers who are members of the union. Right. I hope you didn't have to lobby too hard for their votes.
No.
He's been a member himself since 1982. As a stagehand, he worked at venues all over the city, including Radio City, Madison Square Garden, and of course, most of our Broadway houses. He studied labor and negotiation at both Cornell and Harvard. Never heard of it. And has been serving as an officer of Local One since 96 and was elected president in 2004 and is now on his fourth term. So, Jimmy, before you were president, back when you were a stagehand, which I love, you worked yourself up through the ranks.
Sure.
Tell me a bit about the process of how you became a stagehand in the first place.
Well, I became a stagehand because I followed in the footsteps of my father. It's not unique. I mean, there are a lot of father and sons and nephews and cousins in the industry that doesn't preclude others from getting in the business. But I came in, I'm proud that I came through my father. My father had five of his sons that he trained personally at City Center, which is the 55th Street Dance Theater over on 56th Street. He trained us all for years. We became members, and then we all branched out. I happened to be at City Center for quite a while, and then I branched out to Madison Square Garden. I branched out to actually the television portion of our jurisdiction through the networks. My brothers went through various locations, Radio City, Broadway. We all kind of branched out, and my father did a good thing for us.
Was he a carpenter or electrician?
My father was the head electrician at City Center for about 15 years.
And you were an electrician as well?
I was an electrician at City Center. Later on, and that's why we like to say at Local One, you're a jack of all trades, because Later on, I moved over to at Radio City. I was in the property department. I worked at ABC Television on One Life to Live in either the carpenter department, prop department, or the electric department. And I think that our most successful stagehands are probably ones that are well-rounded. I will suggest that there are stagehands that are far more talented as far as the technical skills, but having a general knowledge in every area will serve you well.
What was the first project that you worked on at City Center? Do you remember?
I do. It was the Music Band with Dick Van Dyke. And that was unusual because City Center is a dance house. So for 13 years, I was the head spotlight operator for a lot of the dance companies, Alvin Ailey, Joffrey Ballet, a lot of the a lot of the incoming ballet companies from around the world and around the country that came in. And I got really exposed to the dance world. But Music Man was a musical, but it was not typical at City Center because it was a dance house. But it was fabulous. It was a terrific experience. You're coming right out of high school. You know, for a guy who wanted to be a baseball player, I became a stagehand. And to experience that was really something quite remarkable.
You were how old?
I was 18.
18 years old.
Right out of high school.
Were you nervous backstage?
No. You know what? I was probably, the boss's son, it probably made it a little bit easier. But you really, when you're backstage, you really have to know what the heck you're doing or you're not going to be successful because you can't be in the way. And City Center, you know, it's much bigger now. It's been renovated and they have larger off-stage space. But back then you had some smaller wings, and if you're not in the right place, it could be dangerous. But my dad taught us really well.
It's funny you said being in the way. On that same production of Grease, I ended up as subbing as a stage manager.
Oh, okay.
And it was at the O'Neill, which doesn't have a lot of experience at all.
Oh, yeah.
And I literally, after about two or three times subbing, running the deck, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Literally, because the stagehand, you know, we talk about choreography on stage. There is as much or more choreography backstage.
Absolutely.
And I just kept getting in the way of stagehands who were not, who were very politely told me, perhaps backstage is not the best. Go in front of the proscenium.
At least they were polite.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
tell me a little bit about the apprentice program, because for those people out there that are listening that I would like to be a stagehand, I would like to get involved. You do have an extensive apprentice program.
Absolutely, and I appreciate that you brought that up. We have an apprentice program that we're very proud of. It's administered by a state organization, so we really don't have control over it. What we do is we try to reach out to all different areas, all different demographics, all different any forms of communication, and reach out to anybody at all that wants to take our apprenticeship program. It's about every 2.5 to 3 years that we offer it, because there's only a certain amount of apprentices that we have to fill positions, and we negotiate them in our contracts for apprentices. But anybody that can do well in a test, typically we're taking the top 40 out of maybe a couple of hundred folks that take the test. And those top 40, we will place them per the order of their aptitude, how their scores go. We also have our replacement room, which is open to the public. So, you know, we encourage folks to come in, and if they can gain some experience, if they have some sort of knowledge, and we can help them through our replacement room and place them with their cancellations or additional hires, that room is open to anybody and everybody that can come in and provide a good service.
But it's very competitive. I like, because you are the top team. I mean, this is the best of the best.
I have an ego about it. And I say, we're the premier stagecraft local on the planet. We're the oldest entertainment union in the United States of America, for folks that don't know. But, like I said, I have an ego, but I carry that with great pride. And I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, and look, it's just like the actors union as well. We have the best people in the world on the stage. I don't care what London says. Don't tell them. But the same.
I'm with you.
The best back as well. Did you go to the theater a lot when you were a kid? Did your dad take you to the...
I did not. Like I said, my whole life, I wanted to be a baseball player, so I was playing baseball, and, you know, occasionally I'd go see a concert here and there, but I was not a theater goer. And, I was not, a big fan of the ballet until, you know, I sat there and I watched it, and I became a very big fan of the ballet, believe it or not. And modern dance and so on, but, over the years, because it's good for my crew to have a presence at their opening nights, and it's good for our employers to see me represent my local, I've gone to more productions, and I have a greater knowledge and a greater respect for from seeing it out front rather than from backstage where I was for so many years. So, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful business.
So after a number of years working as a stagehand, you decided to start to work out of rooms like the one we're in, administrative rooms. What drew you to the other side of the stage?
I was elected, even not by my own choice, I was elected as shop steward at City Center. And then later I was elected as shop steward at Radio City Music Hall when I moved over to there. And frankly, I was pushed by some of my friends who maybe saw a little bit more in myself than I didn't see. And I really wasn't. It was never my dream to be the president of Local One. It was not. It was, you know, I was making a good living and I had a good lifestyle and I was proud of what I was doing. But I had my brothers and my sisters that said, well, we'd really like you to go ahead and make a shot and try to win an election. And I was very, very surprised at my first election. And I ran for chairman of board of trustees and I was, I ran for trustee, but I was elected as chairman to my surprise. And it was a very good experience. And from there, I was pushed further. And finally, I didn't have to push myself. I thought, you know what? I could help my local, and I ran for president later on.
I hear this a lot from people, actually, this mm-hmm. idea of, like, I never thought I would produce this. I never thought I would direct this.
Right.
But the you just said yes along the way.
I did. And you know what? And frankly, I found my niche. You know what? I care about my members. I care about the labor movement. I care about my employers who we have to provide a good service for. And I think that I'm better at what I do now than when I was actually on the stage. And I'm going to bet that some of my brothers and sisters will say the same thing. But, you know what? Everybody has their niche. And, I try to represent them well.
They'd rather see you in here than holding a follow spot. Or...
yes. We might ask them that.
Maybe a few ballerinas are happy about that
yes.
as well. So tell me, you're now the president of Local One. What does that mean? What is your role and responsibility as the president of a union?
My role is, one, is to make sure that our more than 3,200 members of Local One are served. And again, the other is to make sure that our employers are served. I have an executive board that that we're the leadership that are elected by the membership of Local One. I have four business managers who are, frankly, enforce our contracts with employers, but also make sure that we're providing a good service. And I oversee the negotiations of every employer's contract. You know, we have our negotiations, we have grievances, we have issues, but I'm also, I'm supposed to be the lead promoter of the local. I'm a reflection of the local. I'm supposed to be, setting policy. I'm supposed to be a reflection of their sophistication and their honor. And that's every day. That's something that I take very seriously.
And I think a lot of us, again, mistakenly believe that the Local One is just Broadway stagehands, but it's not, as you said. It's television,
yeah.
It's concerts, it's industrials, right, in certain venues.
Many, and we can't overlook the Metropolitan Opera House because, frankly, I know I have an equal amount of stagehands and shop workers at the Met Opera. The same number of stagehands at the Met that I do with all of Broadway combined.
Wow.
Folks do not know that.
I did not know that.
The Metropolitan Opera House is the number one theatrical employer of not only Local One, but the country. So 350 stagehands at the Met. It's a 24-hour operation. You know, they come down a little bit in the summer because the American Ballet Theater goes in there instead of the traditional opera schedule. But we have 350 stagehands there, and we have, the industry as well as I, that, you know, on Broadway, you know, whatever the show is, there could be a greater amount of stage crew on the show, or depending on how much the needs are, it could be less. But the load-ins and the load-outs are predominantly a larger part of our employment, and then the shows, are scaled down. But the Met has as many as all of Broadway combined. And you have Lincoln Center, all the industrials surrounding that, Radio City, Madison Square Garden, and we service every television network and cable. So we're pretty broad out there.
I can't imagine it. The issues are the same in each different medium.
Totally, totally different. And I even try to explain that. You know, I sit on the Central Labor Council, where predominantly they'll say, our contract's up. You know, like the MTA, our contract's up with the city. 75 contracts. So every venue, every space has its own contract. We actually have a benefit with the League of America, with the Broadway League, where They represent with us 31 theaters where we can negotiate, the Nederlanders, Jamson, and Schubers can negotiate a master agreement, and pretty much some of the theaters that surround it we can follow through. But, you know, everybody else has their own individual agreement. They all have to be individually bargained. And it's ongoing. I have 12 open negotiations right now.
12.
And we have to get a deal on each, and we've got to move to the next set. And that's why we have 4 business agents as well.
It can't be an easy gig for you, keeping members of the union that's at the opera and the Broadway happy.
Very true. And it's the same thing with employers. Employers are comparing their contracts with everybody else, and our members are saying, why are we not getting more or less than somebody else's? And it's a delicate balance. You try to please everybody.
You've seen a lot of changes, I would imagine, in our industry over the past couple of decades.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the biggest change that you've noticed in your work?
For the union itself, the biggest changes are, one, the automation, which has reduced, frankly, some of our crews for the shows that I was talking about, and the healthcare crisis that's affected not only our union, every union, but every organization across the country. So, with automation and, becomes greater challenges because of the technical aspects, and you gotta, there's just, as we say this, and it's with respect, we're no longer, the industry of box pushers. Everybody brings a talent. Everybody has to get added knowledge or added skill. And automation has increased, requirements on the load-ins and the tech periods, but when you get to show, you're breaking down to a smaller crew, and that means that some of those folks that run the load-in and the tech period are looking for work elsewhere. And again, as a matter of respect, even to our employers on Broadway, we're now at a really successful period of time where there's shows in the theaters, and there's folks backed up waiting to come in. Some of our members will say, let's wait for the next show. Let's wait for this show to leave and bring the next show in because we have a load-in period where we actually can be employed. So that's contrary to some of our producers, obviously, because they want their show to run for as long as possible. So it's a balance that you have to deal with. The healthcare crisis, everybody's dealing with it, and we're part of that as well. And until somebody with a white horse comes in across this country and changes something, we're all going to be dealing with it. And our employers have, for the most part, acknowledged it and helped us with contributions as part of the bargain.
Yeah, we're all going through. I have a healthcare. I'm an APAM member, which is covered by ATSI now as well. But we all, as a business owner with my employees, we have an issue.
It's a struggle. So,
yeah. And one thing that I've noticed about you is you're a very hands-on president. When I was a company manager and a general manager, I would see you backstage talking to people. Mm-hmm. As a producer, I remember having an issue on Godspell, and I emailed you. Emailed me back right away. We settled the issue with the business rep. Mm-hmm. Do you have a style of management that you would describe, or
you want? And I appreciate you acknowledging that. My style is: I get 110 emails a day, and I try to respond to every email in a moment's notice because I know I'm going to get the following ones follow. I'm sure you have the same thing. I get 90 phone calls a day, just like it's like every other somebody that has a leadership role. I try to tell my members, you make a phone call, I'm going to return a call that day because you need me if you called me that day. I say the same thing to our employers because I respect their needs as well. But my style is deal with it now because it's not going away, and don't deal with something, later that you can take care of now. And I'm very, very sincere that I have to provide a service to both our members and to the employer, and I need to do that with honor. And I live by that.
I have a 2-minute rule. If I can respond or solve the problem within 2 minutes, I have to do it right then and there. That's what I tell my employees.
Well, even us, I think I responded to you at midnight and you responded back.
I know.
I was like, wham, because that's when the best time to get it done, because you're just so much, you're on the go. It is what it is.
Do you like dealing directly with producers when producers email you and say, hey, there's an issue. Can we talk about this? Or does it?
I'll deal with anybody that's going to have a productive resolve. Frankly, there's not a lot of producers that contact me directly. Typically, they'll ask a theater owner to call, but I've had producers that have contacted me, and I'm glad to do that. Listen, I'm not going to say no to anybody that it's going to have a result. I really am not. And again, first and foremost, I need to be a gentleman.
Who are your favorite producers, and who are your least favorite? I'm just kidding. You don't have to. You don't have to answer that. I may know the answer to that question anyway. Let's talk. You were president during the one strike in the union's 100-plus year history, 2007, which was, again, it was the first strike. What was it about that time that which things got to such a head that they had never been before? For both sides, actually, do you think?
My view on that is that, I'm going to be honest, and even some of my friends on the other side of the table might not appreciate it, but I think that it was a time that where the producers were becoming more vocal and the producers were becoming more demanding, and the theater owners who in the past, and listen, my job is to review the past and see the history, and the theater owners frankly controlled our negotiations in the past, and I saw a turn where the producers had more involvement. And frankly, it's their money on the productions, and they want to see, they have demands, and they want to see results. And I saw that change. With the strike, which is unfortunate because nobody wins with a strike. I can tell you our own internal problems with our international was part of it. I'm going to say it. I think that maybe, our international at the time, because it's totally different now, it might have created politics that shouldn't have been. And we didn't have the relationship back then that we do now. I mean, that's actually, it's healed, really well. I've had relationships with the folks in the Broadway League in the past, and they didn't apologize. They wanted cuts. They wanted serious cuts. And it's my job, it's all the union's leadership job to protect, the money that our folks are making. You try to find that balance. They want to give us less and we want to make more. And you try to find the middle ground. And it was unfortunate that it came to that. But we can sit in the room now, and I think that I'd like to think that I matured out of that as well and try to get a better understanding, and I have better relationships with the same people in the room now.
That's actually was my next comment, as after that strike, there's been one or two negotiations since that.
2007, so 2010, so there's been two. So it's been, there was a 5-year deal. So there's been one. So we go back to the table this summer.
Soon.
Yeah.
And I have heard really, didn't hear anything about the first negotiation. I haven't heard really anything about the second. So it does feel like things have quieted down on the relationship front between the two parties.
It was very fragile right after the strike. And we all knew that. But I think everybody had a little bit of a relief because, you know what? The result of that negotiation was, we gave and we got. And the Broadway League, they gave and they got. And both sides suffered. At the same time, I think there was also a little bit of added respect for both sides, and I'd like to believe that. But since then, we had a negotiation that was very cordial. It was uneventful, frankly. But even since then now, I think that the relationship has even grown much, much better. Like I said, I'd like to think that I learned as much as maybe the other folks did, and that we all figured out a little bit better.
Looking ahead to the future a little bit, what do you think about, and I ask your opinion on this as an audience member, mm-hmm. as well as the president of the Stagehand Union, what do you think about telecasting, Broadway shows being shown in theaters around the country, like it is at the opera, actually, where you have a deal there.
We do have a deal. I'm going to tell you, I don't know if I have an educated guess. My opinion is that whatever promotion that we can possibly do to sell tickets is a good thing, and at a price that the audience can afford. Our concern at the Met was that we were, the market was being challenged because of that. And until I see some sort of statistic, I can't really give an educated guess on that. But at the end of the day, if we can get the shows out there and folks can see them, it's going to bring them, bring them into the theater. That's a good thing. I don't know if I've actually seen that at the Met, though. And that's the only thing that I can really, really leave an example for.
And I actually don't know the answer to this question. Mm-hmm. Broadway doesn't have a deal in place to do this, right? We have, if we wanted to do this, if I was producing a Broadway show and I said, I want a show that's in movie theaters. There's some precedent there for some shows that have done it, but there's no formula for it.
There was an organization, it had to be 13, 14 years ago. There was a Broadway television network that tried to bring up that concept, and I think there was one example. There was a show years ago that Carol Burnett was what it, and they broadcast it, but that deal has since expired because it was untested. It really didn't, it wasn't really something that worked. You know, pretty much now, if you do a broadcast, we would negotiate a buyout fee, as all the other unions would for the folks that have creative involvement with the show. But no, there is no general agreement in place. And frankly, we've come accustomed, you know, if that would come up, we would just sit down and we'd negotiate a deal.
I joked about your favorite, least favorite producers, but all joking aside, you've worked with a lot of them. You've seen a lot of them. You've negotiated with many of them. You've been at opening night parties with many of them, charity events.
Sure.
What are some of the qualities that you think make a great producer today in this market?
For myself, you know, and I'm going to tell you, and I don't know if it's going to be like a cliche, but a producer just like anybody else, if they're creative and they have respect for the product they're producing and the folks that are you know, making that product and they're prepared and they're willing to acknowledge everybody's, you know, input. To me, not only a producer, but anybody in our industry, I'm going to appreciate that person. And I'm also going to respect that they say, listen, there's things that you can help us with. And I'm willing to listen to that. And again, it's only what my authority can grab. At the end of the day, you know, if I'm asking them to allow input, I'm going to say, hey, why don't you give us some input as well? So with anybody that's going to respect anybody's opinion and involvement and allow creativity, I'm on board with that.
Where do you see labor relations? You said you're interested in the labor movement as a whole, not just in Broadway. Where do you see labor going in the next 20, 50 years?
You know what? New York City is the number one, you know, labor city in the country, if not the world. So the same struggles that are around the country right now are not necessarily existing now, but they could come here. For folks that don't care about the labor movement, you know, versus somebody like me who leads a labor organization, the challenges across the country where states are trying to eliminate the ability for collective bargaining, and I think collective bargaining overall is, you know, I think it's a right that folks have to say, like what I just said. Come at the table, talk about what each other's requirements are, talk about whatever each other's needs are, and try to come out to a mutual agreement. And I never saw, you know, I thought I would never see in my lifetime where there would be states suggesting that collective bargaining wasn't a right for anybody in this country or a right to even, you know, choose a union to represent them. And if it can happen in Wisconsin, if it can happen in Indiana, you know, it might take a whole lot of time, but it could happen here as well. So, you know, unions as a whole are under attack, and maybe a lot of it is justified. And I'd like to think in the cases where I believe some locals are sophisticated and honorable and doing the right thing and providing a good service, I don't think that's warranted. So to each their own, but, I'd like to think that we're more successful than most.
There are lots of jokes about producers out there, and you made a comment of we're not a union of box pushers anymore. Yeah. Are there any myths about stagehands that you'd like to dispel? Like, what's the biggest myth when you hear, like, oh, geez, not the how many stagehands does it take to turn in a light bulb joke? Right. What like, irks you about some people's public perception of the powerful, almighty stagehands union?
Yeah, the biggest thing that irks me, and it irks some of our members, is when it comes out in the press, and typically it'll happen. Listen, it's all fair game. It comes out in the press, and how much money are stagehands in? It usually comes out before a major negotiation. Listen, it's all fun and
I wonder how
war.
That happens.
Yeah, and you know what? But again, that's part of the process. It's all love and war. You know, that's a small group that will earn that kind of money. But even when they put that kind of money in the paper, it's not all telling the truth. So when they put in there that they're making certain hundreds of thousands of dollars, that's inclusive of their welfare coverage. That's inclusive of their pension fund contribution. That's inclusive of their sick day amount. And it's kind of unfortunate because it's very misleading. I'm not going to suggest that anybody's eating cat food at Carnegie Hall from our crew or some of our other crews, but I will tell you that some of our members that who are not coming close to those earnings are disturbed by the whole myth, which is a good word, that everybody's making that. Because they have a lot of members that are trying to get by, And I have a lot of members that are in the median of earnings, and I have a lot of members who are more fortunate than others, making more. But it's just a generalization that, you know, those making at Carnegie Hall, which is still a kind of expanded number, it's not typical of everywhere else. But you know what? It's all fair in love, and you know, and you do what you got to do.
All fair in love and labor.
Yeah.
It's funny. I never thought about that, though. You may get calls from producers saying, "I can't believe these people make so much money," but you also may get calls from members going, "Like, I can't believe they're making that much money. I'm not making that much money."
Yeah, and they necessarily wouldn't. Even the average member that makes a certain amount, you know, they're not. If somebody makes $60,000, you're not putting in the press that they're making the, you know, whatever it costs for their health care. So you add, you know, $10,000 on top of that. Whatever their pension contribution is, you add another $10,000. Whatever their sick day value. No, the wage is the actual wage that they're taking home each week and they're adding at the end of the year. It's unfortunate that the press accumulates all the significant of different contributions because it's very, very misleading. Again, I'm not suggesting that some of our folks are not doing well, but not as well as people think.
Okay, my last question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to your office, knocks on the door, and says, "Jimmy, you've been a great president for now your fourth term and a great commitment to the local and to the labor movement. I'm going to grant you one wish. You can change whatever it is in our industry that drives you crazy, that upsets you, that keeps you up at night, whatever it is that really bugs you." It can be answers to this have varied from sippy cups to ticket prices. So it could be just the one thing that really gets at your craw about this industry that with the snap of a finger, that genie would change instantly. What would that one thing be?
I got to come back to that. You're going to tell me. I'm going to think of something. Is that the last question?
That was the last question.
All right, so you stumped me on the very last question. I got to think about that. It's actually interesting because I've never really thought about that.
Could be Sundays, all Sundays off, so you could spend time with your children. It could be.
Well, if you want to know the big thing is that New Year's Eve, where I don't think that anybody should be out on New Year's Eve. So, yes, if I'm really thinking about something, that's probably the thing that bothers me because I think it's dangerous out there. That's unfortunate, but I also think that it's a challenge for folks to get home. But what I'm thinking is that if that's the only thing I can think of. Things aren't so bad, are they? Right? Things are not so bad. I'm sure if I had some time, I could think of. But it's really, if that's the thing I could think of, that's I think we're doing okay. But no, New Year's Eve, and we've actually talked about, especially with the Broadway League, about adjusting the schedule and trying to negotiate something because they recognize that it's a problem too.
It used to be that everyone did shows on New, like everybody was. When I was at Showboat, we had a champagne toast at midnight. Yeah. It was a big deal. Now it's much less, right?
It's been addressed, and because, like I said, it's unfortunate, but it has become pretty dangerous out there on New Year's Eve.
And so. you get holiday pay for New Year's Eve, right?
Not really.
No, New Year's Day.
New Year's Day, which is rare.
So no, we can work New Year's Day.
We can work New Year's Day. So here's what it is.
Jimmy, thank you so much for spending time with me and the listeners today. You know, before I asked you to do this, I told one of my peers that I was hoping to get you on the podcast, and one of my peers literally said, "He'll never do it." Mm-hmm. And as you indicated before, you responded to me faster to my request for doing this than anyone else I've asked. And you said, and I quote, in that email that I asked for this interview, you said, "If an interview will help promote our industry, I will gladly do it." So thank you, Jimmy, for spending time with me today and for reminding all of us that even though we're on opposite sides of the table sometimes, we're as a whole, we're on the same team, all rooting for the success of Broadway. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks for being here. And don't forget to subscribe to the blog and the podcast. Fun guests are coming up, including an actual Tony nominator. Ooh, tune in next time.
You've been listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast. This episode was sponsored by the Tony-nominated play Hand to God. New York Magazine says Hand to God is irresistible, intelligent, and heartbreaking. It's Broadway's unlikeliest new must-see play. Get tickets to Hand to God at telecharge.com.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway, here I come.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.